The seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras-Inglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable. And it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In their opening comments, President Biden spoke of cooperation between the two in areas such as food security, security assistance. And the Angolan president also spoke for the need for high-tension electricity generation. These are just bread-and-butter development issues that the two countries say they're working on together, and the Biden administration has hailed this as the beginning of a new relationship.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Luanda on President Biden's Angola visit. Details coming up also. An unknown disease has killed 143 people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And Namibia appears headed for its first woman president after last week's election. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. U.S. President Joe Biden held talks with his Angolan counterpart, Joao Lourenço, in Luanda today during the start of his visit.
I'm very proud to be the first American president to visit Angola. And I'm deeply proud of everything we have done together to transform our partnership thus far. There's so much ahead of us, so much we can do. I want to thank you very much for your personal welcome.
Biden is using the first visit to Angola by a U.S. president to promote Washington's investments in the sub-Sahara African nation. In visiting a slavery museum, Biden acknowledged the trafficking of human beings that once linked the two nations' economies. To brief us more on the visit, I talked to VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell, who is in Angola's capital, Luanda, with the president.
I'm speaking to you from balmy Luanda, the capital of Angola, and I'm sitting right outside the Pink Presidential Palace, where President Joe Biden just met with President João Lourenço, the president of Angola. The two exchanged pleasantries. They had a formal welcoming ceremony where the band played both national anthems, and then both leaders got down to work with their delegations. In their opening comments, President Biden spoke of cooperation between the two in areas such as food security, security assistance, and the Angolan president also spoke for the need for high-tension electricity generation. These are just bread-and-butter development issues that the two countries say they're working on together, and the Biden administration has hailed this as the beginning of a new relationship. As you know, Yehias, this is the first visit ever to Angola by an American president. And as you also know, this is the first and only visit to Africa by Joe Biden, who, of course, is going to leave office in January.
And Anita, one of the centerpieces of his trip is showcasing a U.S. commitment of the $3 billion for the Lobito Corridor, the railway redevelopment linking Zambia, Congo, and Angola.
Yes, both presidents did speak of that massive development project, which aims to connect basically the African continent from one ocean to the other, traversing Zambia, Congo, and Angola on its way out to the Lobito port and from there out to the world. President Joe Biden is going to visit this port on Wednesday. That will be tomorrow. And he will see for himself how much progress has been made on this nearly completed 1,300-kilometer rail line, which has drastically cut the travel time of minerals from Congo to the Lobito port from months on the road to mere days. So this is a big advancement, something that President Biden has repeatedly mentioned and is very excited about. As you well know as well, the president likes to say that he's a rail guy because he rode American commuter rail for many years. So this is something that's both close to his heart, but also an important development project, according to the Biden administration.
And also something to do with slavery. Biden actually met with Wanda Tucker, the descendant of William Tucker, the first enslaved child born in the United States.
You're correct. President Biden is also acknowledging the painful history between Angola and the Americas. Of course, this is before the establishment of the United States as we know it. But it's just under half of today's Black Americans are descended from Central, Southwest or West Africa. So a lot of Americans have a blood connection to Angola, and that's something he acknowledged by, first of all, meeting with this American, but also he is going to deliver remarks today at the National Slavery Museum, where he's going to acknowledge the pain and the duress that that caused the people of this beautiful country.
And lastly, Anita, anything about Hunter Biden?
Of course, Hunter Biden was mentioned, but only by the press. We have shouted questions to the president asking him, you know, what influenced him to change his mind after saying for so long that he wasn't going to pardon his son, but he hasn't responded. But no, he hasn't said anything beyond his original statement, which was lengthy, as you know, and, you know, detailing his change of mind and his decision this weekend to pardon his son.
So how long is he going to stay there, and what are the schedules for tomorrow and the day after?
President Biden's going to have a full day Wednesday as he travels to the Lobito port. He's going to go to Western Angola and see for himself the development project. And today we're still in Luanda, and we're, as I said, he's meeting with the president of Angola right now, and then he will deliver remarks at the National Slavery Museum, and that's what's on the schedule for today.
That was VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell. She talked to me by phone from Luanda, Angola's capital. An unknown disease killed 143 people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo's southwestern province in November, according to Reuters. Remy Saki, the deputy governor of Kwango province, and Apollinaire Yumba, the provincial minister of health, say infected people have flu-like symptoms, including high fever and severe headaches. A medical team has been sent to the Panzi Health Zone to collect samples for analysis to identify the disease. A civil society leader says the number of infected people continues to rise, and there is concern about the supply of medicines reaching rural areas. A WHO spokesperson said today that the UN Health Agency was alerted to the presence of the disease last week, and it was working alongside the DRC's Public Health Ministry to make further investigations. Elections in Africa are often marked by high stakes and heightened tensions, which is decidedly unhealthy for voters. Experts in Ghana say campaign activities, voter fatigue, and fear of political tension and violence can be deadly. Sinanu Tord reports from Accra, Ghana.
According to the Armed Conflict Location and Events Data, ACLED, an independent NGO collecting data on violent conflicts and protests around the world, since 2000, nearly 50% of election-related violence globally has occurred in Africa, exposing citizens to significant health risk. Ghanaian Ministry of Health National Ambulance Service Director of Operations, Foster Ansombrijan, says while violence is a concern, road crashes are the leading health hazard during elections.
Because of the parties moving around, campaigning, some deep into the night, and so the drivers become tired. And so, as we know, driver fatigue also leads to crashes, road traffic crashes. So we've observed that anytime we are in an election, the number of crashes goes up.
According to the National Road Safety Authority, during election years, road crashes in Ghana spiked by approximately 10%, as security resources are often redirected to crowd control and campaign security. Limited road law enforcement during these periods exacerbates the problem. Anson Brijan says another health concern is physical exhaustion and dehydration. Long hours at campaign events and standing in queues to vote can take a toll on citizens.
Some of them, they don't even eat because they want to go early and then go and cast their votes. So they don't eat. They will stay in the queue for a very longer time. And some become dehydrated. Some also become hypoglycemia sets in because they've not eaten. And so some may be faint. Some may even collapse.
Isaac Newman Arthur is a clinical psychologist and spokesperson for the Ghana Psychologist Association. He says beyond physical health, the stress and tension surrounding elections can severely impact mental well-being, especially for individuals with pre-existing conditions.
Depending on whatever happened during the political season, someone may never recover from the impact of whatever they went through, and that can be lifelong.
As Ghana gears up for elections on December 7, 2024, to elect the president and members of parliament, the National Ambulance Service is stepping up its preparedness to address these health risks. Its Emergency Medical Services Supervisor, Daniel Asari, says they are equipped with modern ambulances and trained personnel to help mitigate health hazards.
National Ambulance Service have been able to give basic first aid training to these institutions like the police service, fire service and immigration and prisons. So we did a training program for them so that they will be able to get certain basic first knowledge.
Authorities at Ghana's ambulance service say while elections mark a pivotal moment in democracy, they also bring health challenges, and their goal is to make exercising their democratic rights as safe as possible for all citizens. Sana Anutod, VOA Africa, Accra, Ghana.
In recent days, millions of people in southern Africa were hit with long electricity blackouts, a crisis authorities blame on mismanagement and corruption, but also on climate change. A drought made worse by the El Niño phenomenon means hydropower turbines at the Kariba Dam cannot generate enough electricity, with the reservoir almost empty. Darren Taylor reports.
The once mighty Zambezi River, which feeds the Kariba Dam hydropower station Zambia and Zimbabwe share, is down to a trickle. In many places, it's dry. The livelihoods of farmers and fishermen and women who've relied on the waterway for generations have been destroyed. The United Nations says months of drought, worsened by record high temperatures, have had a devastating impact on almost 30 million people and caused the region's worst hunger crisis in decades. And now it's turning the lights off. As the drought intensifies, it causes the hydroelectric infrastructure on Kariba Dam to break down because there's not enough water supply. According to energy analysts, the Kariba hydropower project is down to its last 10% of usable water. In Harare, civil society leader and lawyer Tendai Mbofana says the energy crisis is compounding Zimbabwe's economic struggles.
Power will be back after 18 hours, 11, 12 midnight. So most households go without electricity most of the day. Even if we do have electricity here where I am today, it can go anytime without notice, without warning. There's no timetable.
Like neighboring South Africa, Zimbabwe has for years implemented load shedding, cutting electricity in some areas for hours at a time because supply cannot meet demand. Mbofana says outages used to last a few hours. Now, with Kariba not supplying power and breakdowns at the country's coal-fired power stations, they can last days.
We are most reliant on antiquated equipment from the 1950s, 1960s, from the colonial era. Right now, I was talking a few weeks back to one of the former board members of the Zimbabwe Electricity Supply Authority, and they were saying, Tendai, don't let these people lie to you. Most of our equipment is obsolete. It's irreparable. At any time, those plants can just shut down and they'll not be able to switch them back on. It's like we are hanging by a thread. It can snap at any time. It would not surprise anyone if this country was to be thrown into a perpetual blackout.
Zambia gets most of its electricity from a hydropower station on Kariba Dam. With no supply at times, the country is enduring blackouts that last days. President of the Zambia Association of Manufacturers, Ashu Sagar, said during a recent Financial Insight webinar in Lusaka, the economy is being impacted badly.
It's had issues in terms of cutting production time. Manufacturing is a very, very time and labor intensive in the sense that you try and use a factory for 24 hours. Using it for 12 hours is really not using your capital investment to its optimum. If you don't have power, you cannot produce. Some manufacturers are holding on, trying to reassign people through the shifts to make sure that you don't send anyone home. But there may be some who can't afford. If you cannot manufacture and you cannot keep your volumes, you cannot meet your fixed costs, you have to reassess your situation.
Not so long ago, South Africa would supply electricity-starved neighbors with surplus from its huge coal-fired power stations. But these days, largely because of mismanagement at its state power company, South Africa doesn't have enough electricity to meet its own needs. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. Every Wednesdays, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. Namibia appears headed for its first woman president with two-thirds of the votes from last week's election counted by early today. The French news agency AFP reports the tally gives the governing party candidate a strong lead in a vote the main opposition has already rejected as a sham. Vice President Nitumbo Nandi Inditua from the SWAPO party has just over 54% of the votes, according to an Electoral Commission tally of nearly 66% of the votes. The leader of the main opposition, Independent Patriots for Change, Pandulina Itula, was well behind with just over 28% of the votes. Nandi Inditua could be forced into a second-round runoff if she does not have more than 50% of the votes when all results are in, which could be as early as today. SWAPO has governed Namibia since leading it to independence from apartheid South Africa in 1990, but high youth unemployment and enduring inequalities have disenchanted younger voters. Russia's mercenary Wagner group remains active even after the death of its leader, Evgeny Prigozhin, in August of 2023. Russian experts say the group has been drawn close to Kremlin power structures and is still fighting to advance Moscow's interests around the world. Matthew Kupfer has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
Up until his death in August of 2023, Yevgeny Prigozhin was the leader and face of the mercenary Wagner Group. In 2014, the group began sending thousands of mercenaries to fight for Russia's interest in Ukraine and the Middle East. John Lechner is a journalist and researcher.
We saw a lot of close cooperation with the Ministry of Defense and other Russian institutions in places like Ukraine in 2014, in Syria.
The group also began operating in Africa. By the end of 2019, Wagner had offices in 20 African countries. Claims began to surface that Wagner was responsible for war crimes and the murder of African civilians. John Lechner.
But once you were getting to these places in sub-Saharan Africa, really there wasn't much of a Russian state presence except for Yevgeny Prigozhin's structures. And so Prigozhin and Wagner were very much actually creating what Russia's national interests in Africa in these places were.
But in June of 2023, Prigozhin's relationship with the Kremlin ended after he led a brief uprising against the Russian authorities. Just 2 months later, he died in a plane crash. Some analysts believe he was intentionally killed. Since then, the Kremlin integrated the Wagner group into the Russian military. Ilya Brabanov is a Russian journalist.
Over the last year and a half, we've seen Prigozhin's empire pulled apart into a variety of structures. Someone goes to the defense ministry. Someone goes to the Russian National Guard. Someone goes to Chechnya's Ahmad Special Forces. Someone goes elsewhere.
Ukrainian analyst Maria Kucherenko says the changes point to the role of Russia's military intelligence, commonly known as the GRU, in Wagner.
From the very beginning till now, it was under the command of GRU, and actually nothing has changed when it comes to the main structure responsible for the existence and for the activity of this group.
Wagner no longer officially fights in Ukraine, but ex-mercenaries do. That conflict could determine the future role of Russian mercenaries abroad. Again, Ilya Barabanov.
The Russian government will have a huge human resource of veterans who fought in this war, and they can probably be used in other, far-off conflicts.
For Matthew Kupfer in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
Los Angeles has approved the so-called Sanctuary City Ordinance. It is a response to President-elect Donald Trump's promise of mass deportations when he assumes the presidency in January. The ordinance won't stop federal officials from deporting undocumented immigrants, but it reinforces the city's vow to protect its immigrant population. Angelina Bagdasarian has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Claudia Ventura has lived in Los Angeles for 20 years. She has a job and a family here, but no legal documentation. Ventura is among the roughly 800,000 LA residents who lack U.S. legal status. And like many others, she feels uneasy after Donald Trump won the presidential election.
Now, when I see not a lot of people in the street, it's less people, it's bad. Yeah, I think the people are scared for the deportation.
The Los Angeles City Council approved a so-called Sanctuary City Ordinance on November 19th. This means local police and state authorities are not going to share information on people's immigration status with federal immigration authorities unless it involves a serious crime. Human rights activists like Jorge Mario Cabrera from the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, or CHURLA, support the ordinance.
A city ordinance like this sends a very strong message to the community in Los Angeles and to the rest of the nation that in Los Angeles, resources available will be used for the purposes of keeping the community safe, of keeping the community trusting in their own leaders, and in keeping the community thriving, not in arresting them or causing chaos in their community.
Yet not everyone in the city agrees with this decision. Trump supporters, roughly 38% of residents, according to the election results, don't want LA to be a sanctuary city.
I think it's a disgrace. I think that we have to take care of our own first. When we say America first, it doesn't mean you don't take care of others. It just means we take care of our own first.
Linda Hanna's parents are from Mexico. They came into the United States legally, and she believes whoever has done so illegally should be deported. The ordinance will have little practical effect because LA has barred police or immigration officials from questioning a person about their immigration status since 1979. The LA's new status doesn't mean there can't be deportations. It just means that local authorities won't help federal officers find and deport undocumented immigrants. Immigration attorney Tatiana Edwards-Behar.
I think that federal officers will start with mass raids as opposed to asking random passersby for documents on the streets. I believe there will be mass raids at factories and in the agricultural industry where, according to official data, undocumented immigrants are most likely to work.
Cabrera believes amnesty is a better idea than deportations.
We have to insist that mass legalization is the option. We have to insist that there's a better way to treat immigrants in this country.
After the inauguration on January 20th, Trump has strongly suggested he might declare a national emergency and use U.S. military personnel to help conduct mass deportations, a move that immigration advocates have vowed to fight in court. For Angelina Magdasarian in Los Angeles, California, NRI's VOA News.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.